This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. All right, the first question here is about China. The question is, at present growth rate, Chinese GDP will pass that of the U.S. in 2017. Okay, I'm not sure that's true, but let's accept that as true. What changes do you see coming from that? None. I mean, that's an easy one. I mean, total GDP is meaningless. China has 1.4 billion people. We have 300 million. At some point, just the sheer numbers, and if they continue to grow, they will exceed the U.S. To the extent, I mean, and GDP is a lousy number. I think I've covered this in a previous podcast. This is GDP is a number that really overestimates the role of consumption, underestimates the role of production, and it overestimates, assume government consumption is of the same value as, let's say, investment in production, which is ludicrous. So yeah, Chinese GDP is way overestimated in my view in terms of standard of living, because a big chunk of that GDP is just government spending on, in a sense, digging holes and filling them up, and that creates no wealth, creates no value. So the GDP number is perverted and distorted to begin with. It's a bad number to measure economic success. But let's say the Chinese are more successful than us. If that success is driven by some kind of market economy, if that success is a consequence of the creation of material goods, then the more successful they are, the better it is for us. I mean, I don't resent my neighbor becoming richer than me. I celebrate my neighbor becoming richer than me. It means he's producing stuff that I can consume. It means that he's making the world more efficient, more productive, a better place for me to live in. So I celebrate billionaires and gazillionaires and millionaires all around me. I think the more rich people they are in the world, the better off we are. And what does it mean for a country to be rich? It just means a lot of rich people in that country. There's a lot of wealth being created in that country by individuals, and that's a wonderful, fantastic thing. So I celebrate Chinese economic success. I think it's terrific. I think I benefited from it daily. I know I buy a lot of Chinese goods. If they're more innovative and they're more successful, that's great. As long as I have a job and I can afford them, that's terrific. See, here's a question, kind of a foreign policy related question. So I guess comedian, cultural commentator Pat Condell discusses the adjunct cowardice that seems to have taken hold of the UK since the Salman Rushdie fatwa. That was, I think, 1989. And this is not unique to the UK. Do I have views on this? Sure. I mean, this is absolutely cowardice. The West is cowardice. The West fears, you know, saying anything negative about anybody. It fears identifying the enemy that has attacked us, the enemy that threatened us, the enemy that put out the Salman Rushdie fatwa, the jihadist ideas that dominate the Islamist movement today. And they fear it. And this is driven by multiculturalism. It's driven by altruism. It's driven by an inability, an unwillingness of the West to stand up for itself, to celebrate its own successes, to say, yes, we believe we have the best culture in the world. Reason and individualism are the best philosophical ideas ever invented. And we want to build political systems based on reason and individualism. And if the Muslim world wants to catch up with us, they need to adopt reason and individualism. They need to abandon mysticism and abandon collectivism and abandon violence as a means of attaining their end and join us in being free, in advocating for liberty. We don't do that. We don't say that. We don't advocate for that. We are cowards because of our ideas of altruism, which say that we should feel guilty for our success. We should celebrate other people's poverty and suffering. And because of the idea of multiculturalism that, as a consequence of the altruism, says we're no better than anybody else. We're just the same. We're equal. So we should never advocate for our ideas over other people's ideas. That, I think, is the ultimate source. Altruism, multiculturalism, mysticism and collectivism at their root. Okay, a few more. Let's do make this a kind of a foreign policy segment. A few more foreign policy questions. Is there such a thing as international law? Should there be? Is there any context in which the concept of international law is valid? No, 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 and no. There is no such thing as international law. Law has to have an enforcement mechanism. There's no enforcement mechanism in international law. And there's no legislature. There's no somebody who passes international law that is a legitimate player in the world scene. You would have to have world government and a world police force and a world military in order to have international law. And I'm against all of those. So the only thing that should be are treaties, relationships between countries that establish behavior between those two countries, then enforced by the countries involved, where violating the treaty violates the treaty. The treaty goes away. So that is the only sense in which there should be laws, regulations, if you will, that determine relationships between countries. But we shouldn't call it international law. It isn't international law. There's no such thing as international law. Treaties between countries, you could even have multi-treaties where several countries get involved. You could have, you know, conventions of countries that come out with treaties that everybody signs on to. But that doesn't raise it to international law standard. Indeed, if you violate it, what is the enforcement mechanism in a free world in which there are no tariffs, in which the, you know, countries are basically there to protect individual rights? Okay, here's a short one. Would you support the idea of kicking Turkey out of NATO and declaring Turkey a hostile terror-supporting entity? I'm for kicking the United States out of NATO. So I don't believe in NATO, period. I think the U.S. should leave NATO. I don't see what it's doing there. I don't think NATO should have ever been created. It's not the United States' job to protect Europe from the Russians or anybody else. It's not the U.S. job to protect the Turks from its enemies, you know, whoever those may be, unless those enemies are also the U.S.'s enemies. But then the U.S. doesn't need Turkey in order to defend itself. It has the mightiest military force in human history. It could crush any enemy. It's just a question of its commitment to do so. So the U.S. should leave NATO. The U.S. should bring the troops home. I don't think Turkey is yet a hostile terrorist-supporting entity. It might become one. You could argue it's heading in that direction. It's certainly heading away from freedom and liberty. It's certainly violating the individual rights of its own citizens on an ever-growing scale. But I don't think it's the enemy yet. I think it needs to be monitored. I think if it becomes the enemy, then yeah, treat it as an enemy. But the United States knows who the enemies are, and it needs to have a clear-cut foreign policy that deals with those enemies. And if it does, then I think the United States can be as safe as one could possibly imagine a country being in the world we live in. The problem is that we're wimps. We won't deal with the enemies. We won't declare them as enemies. We won't act on them as if they're enemies. Again, we don't need NATO. NATO's insignificant. And actually, this is a good lead-in to a question I got several times, not surprising. And that is, what do I think we should do about the Ukraine and Crimea and Russian aggression in the Ukraine and the Crimea? And my answer is basically nothing. It's none of our business in the big sense. There's no American interest at stake here, no violation of American rights. There's no threat to American lives and property. So my view is nothing. The only thing we should do is be morally outraged at Putin's actions. Putin is a thug. He is a dictator. He is a bad guy. He is an authoritarian, totalitarian. And I don't understand anybody who is out there defending Putin. And this is primarily all those libertarians who somehow blame everything on the United States and Putin is somehow okay. But the United States, that's the real evil in the world. I mean, that is just obscene in my view. Putin is an enemy of freedom, an enemy of liberty, and should be condemned as such. But that doesn't mean one has to do anything. Now, once Putin is a true threat to the United States, then one declares him an enemy, and then one has to decide what one's dealings with him to be. Then an embargo can be appropriate, limiting trade can be appropriate. All these things are appropriate. But for that, one has to declare him an enemy of the American people. In other words, a threat to the individual rights of Americans. And then one has to consider at least military action. But of course, they have nukes. So, you know, I don't think that is an option with Russia. But one certainly can embargo them and not trade with them. But I don't think we're at the point where Putin is a threat to the United States. I think we have to watch him because I think he's heading in that direction. But one has to make the moral statement. Putin is an evil bad guy. What America is doing in the Ukraine, agree with it or disagree with it, does not rise to the kind of involvement, the kind of intervention, the kind of aggression, the kind of anti-freedom action that Putin is taking. So, stay out of it, but declare you know, who the enemy is and who the bad guy is and who you think are the better people. And I think Ukraine generally are better than Russia and deserve our moral support in the struggle. But again, no military. And I find it funny all these conservatives say, oh, we should take the Sixth Fleet into the Black Sea. What's that going to do? One. Two, in the Israeli army, they taught us a simple lesson. Never point a gun at somebody unless you're willing to pull the trigger. Moving the Sixth Fleet in the Black Sea is pointing a gun at Russia. Are we willing to pull the trigger? Are we willing to escalate this into nuclear war because of Crimea? I mean, I don't care that much about Crimea. I mean, I care whenever a thug succeeds, and it's sad, but I'm not willing to put my life, my kids' life at risk because of the Crimea. And that should always be the standard about whether you're willing to go to war or not, is would you put your life or your kid's life at risk for the aim of the war. The GPS system's been a game changer, the questioner says. Absolutely true. I mean, I love GPS. It improves lives. It generates wealth. Yeah, it makes life dramatically better. But the government was clearly heavily involved in developing GPS. I think it comes out of military technology. What would happen in a free market? Well, who knows? First of all, government would still be involved because to the extent that government is involved in a free market in defense, it might be helpful in developing certain technologies that are necessary for defending the country. So GPS might have developed anyway through government funding, in a sense, through the defense industry. In any case, it might not have taken a different route than it has today. But my general view is if the government shrunk by 90%, which I think it can and should, imagine what all that capital could do in private hands. And if all the regulations tomorrow were lifted off of business and off of entrepreneurs and all the disincentives to entrepreneurs were taken away, imagine, the point is you can't imagine. That's the problem. I can't imagine. The kind of products, the kind of wealth, the kind of innovation that would happen. I mean, GPS maybe is a primitive technology as compared to what is possible and what would have developed. So, you know, this is true of a lot of things. A lot of cancer treatment starts with basic research funded by the government. But imagine what would happen if private enterprise was funding all this stuff with a massive quantity of capital that were available to it because it wasn't funding government waste. Imagine if taxes were nothing, right? Were so low that you kept all of your income, right? Or 90% of your income were just kept, and this was true of at every level of wealth, then it's just unimaginable the kind of wealth and kind of prosperity. I mean, GPS is wonderful, but who knows what would have happened if not? All I can guarantee you, I don't know exactly what would have happened, but I can guarantee you this. It would be so much better. We would be so much wealthier that it's hard for you, even the most imaginative of you, even those of you who might be experts in science fiction and fantasy, you'd still have a hard time imagining how good things could be.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.